It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we begin our summer series, Ripple Effects, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges. For the next 4 weeks on Talk of Iowa and River to River on Mondays, we'll be talking about different environmental challenges that Iowa's facing. And today is all about trash. This morning on Talk of Iowa, we'll talk recycling. And at noon on River to River, we'll find out what happens to all of the stuff that can't be or is not being recycled. We'll visit a can shed this hour, we'll talk about composting, and we'll find out about some innovative ideas for getting more out of our trash. But first, let's find out how we're doing right now. Teresa Kurtz is with me. She is Executive Director of the Iowa Recycling Association. Hello, Teresa.
Well, hello, good morning, and thank you for covering such an important topic.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back in time to when recycling programs first began, which is about 25 to 30 years ago. This idea was pretty new, that we would sort out different parts of our trash and they would be recycled and become new products in the end. When those recycling programs first began, what were our goals?
Our goals were to collect as much as we could, predominantly curbside, I think, and we set some waste diversion rates, like, for instance, 25% and then up to 50%. So we set some lofty goals for the state and actually across the nation to reduce as much as we could through the recycling stream.
All right. And we did reach that 25% goal, right?
We did eventually. Actually, in the last decade, we've seen an increase to approximately 30, 31, up to 35%. And it's remained rather stagnant at this point. But at one point, when the programs first started and they started some baseline data, we were probably averaging about 17% at that time. So, yeah, we've seen a dramatic increase in the last decade, but again, it's remained pretty stagnant.
All right. And when we talk, I understand that numbers on recycling are really difficult to gather. So I understand that relying on these statistics is a little bit problematic. But just so we can understand sort of a baseline, I want to stick to the numbers for a little while. When we think about that 30 to 35% that we seem to have topped out in Iowa, how does that compare to other places in the United States?
Actually, we're pretty average, or maybe slightly above average, according to, and I usually rely basically on the EPA figures, and they say the exact same thing. The EPA, nationally, what we're seeing today's rate is at like 34.5%, and in Iowa, we say that we are using a waste diversion rate of about 36%.
How do we compare with other places around the world? And I want to talk specifically about Europe, where I know that recycling programs are considered to be significantly more advanced than ours. How would our percentage compare?
That's definitely a harder number to obtain. Recycling programs in European countries have been around a lot longer, and they have a really great infrastructure built up. So I would assume that their recycling rates are a lot higher.
So in Iowa, where we have seemed to reach this 30 to 35% rate and sort of hold steady, what do you see as the greatest challenges to getting that rate higher?
I think we definitely have some barriers. We have some great things going on. We are currently recycling about 1.2 million tons. And some of the great things that are happening in the state are we have over 11,400 jobs, and we boast an industrial output of over $2.4 billion. So we're seeing some great environmental impacts and also some significant economic impacts in the state. But with the ever-increasing demands that are placed on our natural resources, we definitely see the need for recycling and reuse to continue to grow. So critical to the future growth of recycling would be to nurture some of the existing programs that we have and establish additional collaborative efforts. I think education we need to build awareness for what programs are out there and what resources are available to people. And again, as you alluded to, we need to advocate for accurate data and tracking mechanisms so that we can ensure proper program implementation happens.
Now,
and again, focus on business rural and apartment recycling infrastructure.
Okay, rural and apartment recycling. Let's talk about rural for a moment. A lot of people in Iowa do live in rural areas. I live in one where I can recycle through the refuse company that I use. My parents live in an area in the country where they have to sort their own recycling and take it into town. And a lot of people are in that situation. And for a lot of people, those towns where they do have recycling centers are pretty far away. So let's talk about some of the challenges of rural areas. I mean, there are quite a few rural areas in Iowa that really don't have recycling programs at all, aren't there?
There are. And it's really not economically or efficient to go curbside, you know, picking up at different rural communities or households. But for a state as rural as Iowa, it probably would be most efficient and effective if we developed a rural recycling infrastructure, such as a hub-and-spoke model, which works by creating regional recycling processing centers within larger communities that serve as the hubs, and then the smaller communities would serve as the spoke, where they would collect the recyclables and then deliver them to these hubs.
Are there areas in Iowa where that's already being done?
No, not so much, but I think it has been discussed, and there are great models out there. States such as New Mexico and Colorado, which are both very rural in themselves, are using this program right now and finding it very, very effective.
You mentioned apartment buildings, and that is an area where, of course, you don't have curbside pickup because there's the dumpster and you take your stuff out to the dumpster. Are these places where recycling is just not happening?
Quite often, yes. I think unless the residents, because an apartment is a business, and so it's not mandated that businesses have to recycle. And oftentimes there are space constraints, and so that's a barrier. And so we have to encourage apartment buildings and owners to actually build in some infrastructure where they can provide receptacles for residents of the apartments to recycle.
All right. Are there some other areas where we seem to have problems with this as well?
I'm sorry. Other areas?
Right. So,
other categories?
Other categories, yeah.
Let's see. Some of the other things that we can improve upon. Oh, definitely. There are three specific materials that are currently placed in our landfill system, that if we address these three areas in both the residential and the business sectors, we would save a lot of resources and a lot of space in our landfills. One of those is plastics. We're doing a great job on recycling plastics, but specifically film and the rigid, hard-to-recycle plastics, they are still being buried in the landfill at a rate of about 17%. And this one's surprising to me, but paper and cardboard, which seems like a no-brainer to recycle, is still making up our municipal solid waste at a rate of about 25%.
Wow.
But the very largest material category that could be captured, and there's a lot of attention being paid to it on the state level right now, is the organic and food waste. And that is being discarded at a rate of almost 26%.
Wow. So, and we will focus more on organic and food waste as the hour goes on. You mentioned education. Who is most likely to recycle in Iowa?
Well, there are so many demographic studies, attitudinal and behavioral. They look at those tendencies with regard to recycling. And there have been studies and reports done across the country all over, taking into account age, gender, home ownership, and education. So you're going to see a lot of different data coming out of that. I've seen where they've said college graduates are more likely to recycle. Women aged 55 and older are more likely to recycle. Homeowners are more likely to recycle. And I've even seen cat owners are more likely to recycle. I know that went through me. But essentially, if there is access to recycling, if it's convenient and easy, and coupled with a good public education and outreach program, we will see recycling happening.
We will talk more about some of the changes that we've seen happening to recycling and get into exactly what happens to the things that we put in our recycle bins or we take to the recycling center. But it does strike me that the number of things that we can recycle and that many different companies are willing to take on has expanded over the years. Are we recycling more different kinds of things, a greater variety?
Oh, definitely. And I think that's where, you know, we talk about the recycling rate as being stagnant, but we are definitely seeing more and more different items that can be recycled. And businesses are, which make up about two-thirds, and in some areas of the state, 80% of the municipal solid waste generated, they're really on board. Businesses are having a bigger push to recycle byproducts of their business, not just that commingled material which we put in our carts at the curbside, but it is a very interesting what can be recycled out of businesses. And then, like, I know later in the program you may be talking about bags. There are a lot of take-back programs that we have. So those things that just aren't, you know, again, put in our curbside bins, there are collection systems for batteries, electronics, tires, plastic bags, and, of course, our state bottles and cans.
Right. What is the incentive for a community to have a strong recycling program?
Like, there are probably many incentives for them. Reducing the reliance on disposal in the landfill. It can be economically viable. It attracts businesses. And it makes people want, they're looking for this, they want to recycle, so it makes their residents happy.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Teresa Kurtz. She is Executive Director of the Iowa Recycling Association. And we are taking an in-depth look at recycling in the state of Iowa this hour. In just a moment, we're going to pay a visit to a can shed. We're going to talk about what exactly happens to the stuff that we put in our recycling bin or that we take to the recycling center, how it gets turned into new products, and where some of the big hang-ups are as well, and that food waste number, the organic and food waste problem. We'll tackle that as well. And we also have an opportunity for you to give your feedback this hour in five words or less. We want to know how your attitude toward trash has changed. You can post on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us your questions as well. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring recycling in the state of Iowa. We're also going to look at some innovative programs to get more out of our trash as the hour goes on. But one of the state's oldest recycling programs is our bottle deposit law. And most people have probably taken a bag of aluminum cans to a redemption center to collect those nickel deposits. You walk in, you get them counted, and you collect your money. But what happens next? IPR's Catherine Perkins recently visited the can shed in Cedar Rapids to take a tour with owner and operator Troy Willard. Willard says they process 1.5 million containers per week at the facility, and cans are their bread and butter. It turns out a lot happens after you dump that bag of cans onto the counter.
We are actually kind of the middleman between either the customers or the retailers and the distributors for all the beverage containers with the deposit. Our job is to make sure that the branded cans get back to the correct distributors so they get reimbursed the nickel that they collected when they sold the container in the first place. It's probably not as commonly known as it should be that the distributors actually reimburse us 6 cents for every container instead of five. Back in, 35 years ago when they passed the law, that was the incentive for either the retailers to do the work to sort the stuff back out or, you know, have a sheltered workshop or a privateer like myself come in and say, hey, I can make money at doing this. That penny has been that same penny for that 35 years, and we're always looking for a raise. So what we've advocated for a long time is an increase in the handling fee to keep up with the overhead and the costs that are ever increasing. We've also tried to talk about expansion. The original bottle bill, when it was written, focuses mainly on carbonated beverages and alcoholic beverages because that's what the containers were 35 years ago. We didn't have bottled water. We didn't have iced teas. We didn't have lemonades. We didn't have sport drinks. And what's to be recycled, what's to be deposited, is becoming more and more of a problem because there are so many of these beverages out there now. It would alleviate, you know, eliminate a lot of the confusion. It would also increase the volume of containers coming in, giving us an opportunity to grow our business. The danger there is if we can't make a lot of money at doing it at a penny, more business coming in at little profit doesn't do a lot for us. So that's why we're also advocating for a handling fee increase as well. We call this the Nickel Tour. We've got half a dozen, 16 people on the line. The bags are getting dumped in the front end of the hopper. As it's coming down the line, we're picking off the different distributors other than Pepsi. Pepsi's our biggest distributor, so what we do is we let their cans stay on the line to the very end, so the boxes are filling themselves as they're coming off the end. We start them out with the easy stuff, the Pepsis and the Mountain Dews and that, but as they're here longer, they get an eye for it and start learning some of the nuances or some of the lesser-known brands and who distributes them. The cans are usually, they go back to a smelter, and they're made into sheet stock that end up going back to someplace that's making cans and lids for the distributors. I think I've heard the turnaround on that can coming through the system is even less than 30 days. I mean, that's how fast they can crank it through. If I could tell people one thing, clean and rinse your cans. Most people do a really good job, but that's it's a challenging environment when you got to deal with beer spit and chew spit and bottles that aren't completely empty, and so it gets gummy and it gets gross, and so we like empty, clean containers.
That was Troy Willard, owner and operator of the Can Shed in Cedar Rapids. The audio postcard was produced by Catherine Perkins. And this hour, we are talking about recycling on Talk of Iowa. With me is Teresa Kurtz, Executive Director of the Iowa Recycling Association. And also joining us now is Joe Hummel, Recovered Material Sales Manager at City Carton, a recycling center in Iowa City. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And maybe we should start right where Troy leaves off. He was talking about clean, empty containers, and a lot of us struggle with what we need to do to prepare things to go into our recycling bins. How important is it to have things be clean when you're looking at recycling?
It's definitely important. We appreciate it when people do take the time to rinse out the milk jugs, the peanut butter jars and whatnot before they put them into the bins. It helps us cut down on, the pest problems that would come along with having the food residue. It also helps keep our facility smelling a little bit cleaner and a little bit cleaner for our equipment and better for our employees that are actually doing some of the hand sorting and whatnot that takes place.
If there is residue on the containers, like in a yogurt cup, that kind of thing, does that prevent it from being recycled?
Not necessarily. It's more just from a cleanliness standpoint. Most plastics, once they are sorted and then they head back to wherever they end up to go to be recycled, they go through a washing process at that time, which will remove any leftover residue.
All right. Now, when we first started recycling, there was a lot of sorting and taking the labels off of the cans and crushing the cans. We had to do quite a bit more than it seems like we have to do today, where we just put everything in a bin together. So when you are picking stuff up at the curb and you bring it in, what kind of a sorting process do you have to go through to separate out all of the different things?
Well, materials can be collected together, but they still cannot be recycled together. So plastics are pulled out. Metals are removed. Cardboard is removed. The papers, most paper grades can actually be recycled together in a pack, which is called mixed paper by most paper mills. When it comes down to the sorting, it's all about value adding and, how can you take material that comes in one form and add value to it so that you can create a return to make the recycling program worthwhile.
So why have these, I assume that you have to employ a number of people to do this sorting.
Mm-hmm.
Why collect them in this way? Why did we go through that change to put them all together?
It really, single stream, especially in Linn County, has really increased the recovery rate. I think Teresa earlier mentioned that, you know, we're somewhere between 30 to 35%. I would venture to guess that Linn County is probably higher than that because they have the single stream. We processed 12,500 tons last year in Linn County from the Linn County Solid Waste Agency. And what we do is, you know, we bring it in and we don't just, it's not all hand sorted. We do have a series of equipment that can, you know, help us with the sorting. So it has cut down on the amount of manual labor that we do have to use. So, but it does make it easier, and it's all about making it easier and more accessible for the public.
Lowering those barriers. And Teresa, do you see a big difference in communities that have single stream as opposed to communities that you do have to sort your recycling?
I think that definitely the participation rate by residents that have single stream, there is a greater amount of participation, definitely.
So let's talk about plastics, because when you look at the bottom of all these plastic containers, they have those different numbers on the bottom. And again, that was something we used to have to sort out, the number twos and the number threes and the number fours and all of that. And now it all goes into the same bin. Can those plastics be recycled together, or do you have to sort them?
There is still some secondary sorting that takes place. The reason behind why collection is expanded to include now one through sevens is that because there are more markets now available to us. Traditionally, domestically here, we had only markets for number one, which is PET, and number two, HDPE. Markets have expanded now here in the United States for fours and fives. So that really has helped to drive collection. When you have, you know, a market that you can sell a product into, it will lead to more collection for that particular grade.
Is there a difference in how recyclable those different kinds of plastics are? I see number two plastics, which of course are milk jugs. I see products that are made out of those, mm-hmm. I think, a little more often than I see the other kinds of plastics. So what's the difference?
It comes down to chemistry. A lot of people think that there's maybe just seven different kinds of plastic, but there's probably about 50 or 60,000 different types of plastics. Plastics are a lot like metals, where there's alloys, if you want to think of them as alloys. So HDPE number two, for example, a milk jug is going to melt at a different temperature than a kitty litter bucket, which also is going to be labeled as a number two. So, you know, they have the same chasing arrows on them, but, you know, when it comes down to the recycling process, they're going to be processed in a little bit different way. Therefore, you know, that's why there still has to be secondary sorting that takes place. As far as ease of recyclability, milk jugs tend to be the easiest because and it's not so much the makeup, it's because they haven't had a pigment added to them. So they can actually be used in a wider variety of products after the fact, you know, for a secondary life than maybe something that's like a yellow bucket or whatnot. So
why does the pigment make such a difference?
It's just all about marketability in terms of what the secondary processor wants to do with it. If they take a milk jug that's been hasn't been pigment added to it, they can make that any color that they would like. So if they're going to make plastic playground furniture or plastic playground parts, for example, they could make it pink, they could make it red, yellow, whatever they wanted.
Now we were talking about trash in five words or less, and Matthew in Iowa City says it's worth money. That's his comment. And I'm curious about how a recycling center makes money. Who are you selling these recyclable goods to?
For the most part, paper goes into paper mills here in the United States. And actually, International Paper operates a large mill in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that's one of the largest in the world for recycled cardboard. So that is a great resource for us to have right here in our backyard where we collect the cardboard, we sort it out, we bale it, and then we ship it to the International Paper Mill. Newspaper gets sold into mills that are making newsprint, also mills that could be using it to make insulation for homes. The white office paper that people recycle often gets turned into bath towels, hand towels, tissue towels, stuff like that. And I think napkins as well are also made from a lot of recycled. So, you know, paper mills, for the metal that gets recycled, we sell back to steel mills. Plastics goes to a variety of different plastics manufacturers, whether they're making drainage tile, pipe, park benches, plastic playground equipment, plastic lumber, plastic decking, a lot of those products.
Now, a lot of people who don't recycle make the argument that recycling is so energy intensive that it's really not worth the effort. What's your response to people who say that?
It's actually a misnomer. If you wanted to produce a product from 1 ton of recyclables, the energy requirement for that's going to be about 10.4 million BTUs. Whereas if you're going to produce a ton of product from virgin materials, your energy expenditure is going to be about 23 million BTUs. And the cost and the the carbon footprint in terms of BTUs for processing a ton of recyclables is less than 1 million. So, you have a delta there of almost 13 million BTUs and only 1 million to process it on average. So, yeah, it's just not true.
Now, we have on the recycling front this question from John in Waterloo. He says, I want to know why they haven't invented something that compresses or melts down number 6 styrofoam.
Actually, they do have equipment that will process styrofoam. It's just kind of still in its early stages of development. So it's like a flat screen TV was 5-10 years ago when it cost $4,000. So we're hoping that, you know, as technology increases and more manufacturers enter that marketplace, that the processing costs will lower to the point where it makes it cost effective to do it on a smaller level.
Now, Teresa was mentioning earlier the rigid plastics being a problem as far as recycling goes, and that's something that you're addressing at City Carton, right?
Yes. Rigids and film both. Both of those products or materials, I should say, create problems for our processing just based on the size of our conveyors. The film will actually wrap itself up in our moving parts, so we ask people not to bring the film type of stuff in the bins. Same with the rigids, they'll wedge in the conveyors and they'll create a bridge. So what we'll do is we've added containers at our drop sites so that people can bring those items in and deposit them there, and then we can process them separately. The problem becomes is when they're mixed in with the residential curbside.
Now, Teresa, I want to ask you, there are people who say that in some ways our landfill system is rigged to be in favor of dumping things into the landfill. They feel there aren't enough economic incentives for communities to do a lot of recycling. What do you feel about that?
Oh, no, I don't agree with that at all. I think the issue is the way that recycling is funded. It's kind of a catch-22 that we rely on a certain amount of waste being buried in the landfills to fund recycling programs. However, I do feel that in my heart and in my bones that the solid waste agency system that we have, where almost every planning area is publicly owned and run, whether it be through the local government or a 2080 agreement, and that they are very vested in not being rigged and not wanting to just bury everything. I mean, they're very invested in so many different programs and very innovative in their programs. So that's my 2 cents worth.
Now,
I'm really proud of our system here, except for the funding for recycling.
So if we could do one thing that you feel could get us closer to that 50% mark that was the original goal, what would that be, Teresa?
Oh, I have to pick one.
Yeah.
there are so many things. Make easy access, recycling for everyone, easy access, whether it be through the hub and spoke system or apartment recycling or business recycling. So I'm going to stick with easy access.
All right. How about you, Joe?
Mine would be more of a pay-as-you-throw system, so which is more expensive, obviously, because you would need to basically retrofit an entire fleet of a city. But you could take containers and put an RFID tag in there, have a reader that's on the truck, The truck would then weigh everybody's trash container that week, and you would pay for what you throw away.
So
and
create then, more of a personal incentive
right,
on a weekly basis.
Make recycling either a fixed cost or free, and then make the waste side where you pay as you throw.
When you talk about things that are easy to recycle, like number two plastic, it makes me wonder why we don't see more products sold in number two plastic. Why do you think that is?
I think we're starting to see more. You know, Procter & Gamble recently started doing some of their bottles, their shampoo bottles, back from originally bottle to bottle. And then Pepsi's also doing some bottle to bottle with number one. So, you know, we're starting to see more of that, and that's encouraging.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Joe.
Yeah, thank you.
Joe Hummel, recovered material sales manager at City Carton in Iowa City. And Teresa, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Teresa Kurtz, Executive Director of the Iowa Recycling Association. Coming up, we're going to talk about food waste. We're also going to talk about some innovative programs to get more out of our trash. And you're welcome to send your questions as well. You can send them to Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about recycling on Talk of Iowa. We are kicking off our summer series on the environment, recycling this hour, trash today at noon. And we'd love to get your input as well. We want to know from you in five words, how has your attitude toward trash changed? You can post on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. And now we're going to turn to some innovative ways to get more out of our trash. And one of the biggest problems, in fact, there are towns all over the world that have banned them. One of the biggest problems are plastic bags. And Sue Waters is with us now. She's Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Plastic Recycling of Iowa Falls. She's here to talk about their Build with Bags program. Hello, Sue.
Well, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Love to be visiting with you.
And a lot of people consider plastic bags to be a huge menace. They do tend to get away, fly away. You find them out in the environment, but they are reusable. How did this program get started?
The program actually started 4 years ago. It was a cooperative effort with the Iowa Grocery Industry Association, Keep Iowa Beautiful, Des Moines Area Metro Waste Authority, the DNR, and Des Moines Register. And it was a program that was implemented to encourage the recycling of the plastic bags in various communities. The goal was to reduce the consumption of the plastic bags, increase use of recyclable bags, and encourage individuals, communities, schools to recycle these in exchange for grants, money that they could then utilize purchasing recycled plastic park furniture that we manufacture, like the park benches and the picnic tables.
Okay, so park benches, picnic tables, playground equipment, even speed bumps, right?
Correct.
So how many plastic bags does it take to create a bench?
We calculated that it took approximately 60 grocery bags to equal 1 pound of finished product. So if we took a standard 6-foot park bench, which weighs approximately 200 pounds, you would have close to 12,000 grocery bags in that park bench.
Wow.
It's a huge number.
Absolutely. And this is something that, does it get collected through recycling programs in different communities, or are you having people drop off their bags at specific locations?
The way that the program works is that the community applying for the grant has to have a local IGIA member, which is typically their local grocery store. For example, if it's Hy-Vee, a lot of times if you go into your local Hy-Vee, you will see a collection bin right inside the door, which is there for you to deposit your bags.
Right. Okay. And then this community gets a grant so they can buy some of these, or to help defray the cost of buying some of these products that get made out of the recycling or recycled materials. And where does the money come from to run the program? That sounds like you're not making a profit in the end.
Correct. It's actually, the program is funded, like I said, it's through the IGIA they're the ones who take care of all of the funding, the award for who receives the grants. They do a total of approximately $50,000 in grant money. I know this year their funding was down a little bit, but each community, school, or whichever can receive up to $2,000.
All right. So this is a way that the Iowa Grocery Industry Association is giving back.
Correct. Along with, you know, Keep Iowa Beautiful,
right,
DNR,
right.
Metro Waste.
So how many pounds of plastic do you process every year?
We recycle approximately 5 million pounds of plastic every year.
Wow. And are you actually manufacturing these products in the state of Iowa?
We do.
How many employees are involved in that?
We have approximately 50 employees. We do run three shifts of production 5 days a week.
And do you know how many park benches you've turned out in the last 4 years?
A lot.
A lot. Well, Sue, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure thing.
Sue Waters is Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Plastic Recycling of Iowa Falls. And we were talking about their Build with Bags program that's been around for 4 years. Now, plastic bags are a huge problem. Another problem that has come up already on the program is food waste. There is an enormous amount of food waste that winds up going into our landfills every year, and that's a special pet project of Scott Koepke. He's chief gardener for SoilMate's Organic Garden Education Service in Iowa City. And Scott, a lot of that food waste could be going to another purpose. It could be going into compost. How big an issue is food waste?
Oh my goodness, Charity. You know, I'd say both at a personal, private, neighborhood level that I work with and the public, institutional, large-scale level with cafeterias and restaurants and grocery stores, what gets me up in the morning is this issue because of a couple statistics, that some of which you've already referenced. But the first one of which is that over half – and in fact, the U.S. Composting Council says 72%, but I'll just back it down to 51 and say that most – of what, and if this doesn't convince people that this is important, I don't know if I can say anything else, but most of what we throw away every day are the carbon and nitrogen, green and brown components, food and paper waste that build organic matter for soil. You know, this is not rocket science, but it is soil science for me on a very personal level. And so there's almost a moral imperative for me because, you know, you asked why should people do this? Yeah, economically they should, but also I think morally we should. I mean, we have another statistic, 40 million hungry people in this country that, you know, and we're throwing away a quarter of our food, you know. So that's a pretty stunning thing, not to mention the fact that the methane gas that's created when we throw all this food into the landfill is just creating a lot of unnecessary greenhouse gas.
If everybody was composting and all of these businesses had access to compost, how much of that food waste could be composted?
Well, it depends on if you're doing it in town or taking advantage of the rare infrastructure that we have available to us here in Johnson and Linn counties. Meat and dairy product, for instance, is typically not incorporated into an urban composting system, although I am working with some very smart fifth grade science club kids this year to do a control group on how to get around that with some high acidity vinegar and some other stuff. But so if we're collecting it in biodegradable bags to take to Jennifer at the landfill or Jason at Linn County, that's when you can take meat, dairy, bones, everything, and it's all, you know, because it's zoned agricultural, at least in the case here in Johnson County. So it's a little bit less of a logistical problem. But again, what I'm trying to get people to understand is that we're building organic matter. This is a biology lesson, you know, that people need to remember. The microbial decomposition of organic matter is yielding chemically available nutrients for roots to absorb. So when I talk about recycling food, I'm talking about compost being food for the food with these kids. They have to understand that food needs to eat first before we eat food. All food, whether you're a vegetarian or meat eater, comes from plants. So all plants need soil. When you build the biology up in soil exponentially with compost tea, cover crops, that is just an incredibly beneficial step that anybody can take in their home garden or their row crop operation. So,
well, and we've been talking this hour about the amount of energy that goes into recycling, and Joe assures us that it's a lower amount than a lot of people think. But with composting, that doesn't take a lot of energy. I mean, that is complete and utter recycling as that stuff goes back into the soil.
It is. And, you know, I totally get how people don't want to do this. You know, there are a lot of misperceptions about odor and time and all that. But I like to walk people through some of those misperceptions. And, I just when we talk about the energy required to do this, again, I don't expect everyone to do it. But what you can do, and this is what I'd like to reinforce about neighborhood projects, is that I'm working with some great kids who will get together with their neighbors and find one person. In my neighborhood, it's me. So people know, like, I'll go home today and there'll probably will be a bucket of rotting vegetable waste on my porch that I will gladly take off people's hands and incorporate into my own home system. Okay, so and then, but at the institutional level, like you say, we still have a long way to go to get more infrastructure in place to incentivize both public and private interests to be able to process this food waste. Because right now, if you're out in the sticks, there's, like you said earlier, there's no place to take this stuff. So we got to get the cart and the horse working here.
Well, and I mean, there is a place if you are willing to compost it yourself, but people are afraid of the amount of work. And as you mentioned, they're afraid of the smell. So what kind of resources can people turn to if they want to learn to do this on their own?
Well, they can get a hold of me, first of all, because I do this for a living. I teach this stuff. And again, it's this carbon to nitrogen ratio I'll go back to. You know, this misperception. Like, okay, good example. I'll have people who will come up to me all the time saying, why am I not getting this finish that you talk about, this black gold that I see that you're making? My first question is, what is your ratio of nitrogen to carbon or greens to browns? And more often than not, I'd say 10 times out of 10, it seems like people have not incorporated near enough browns or carbon source into their compost. It's kind of a 2-to-1 ratio.
Okay, so it can't be just the grass from your lawn.
Yeah, if you're just doing that, that's when you are going to get an anaerobic situation where it's not going to smell right. But good compost smells like incredible earth. So
it's good science, but it's simple science.
It's so simple I can even figure it out.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking an interest again, Charity, in this passion of mine.
Scott Koepke is Chief Gardener for SoilMate's Organic Garden Education Service. And so we've talked about all those plastic bags. We've talked about the food waste. But the truth of the matter is that a lot of this stuff just isn't going to be recycled, at least not immediately. Well, Stacy Johnson is Education Outreach and Market Development Coordinator for FiberRight in Linn County. And this is an organization that is trying to recycle stuff that is getting thrown away. Hello, Stacy.
Hi, Charity.
And give us a little bit of an idea of how FiberRight can reclaim this recyclable stuff from the landfill.
Well, I like to explain it. It's more of an insurance policy that things will get recycled. And it's FiberRight is not a company that wants to replace how, you know, people are, including me. Recycling is near and dear to my heart, so I want to recycle. That's the highest and best use of our recyclables, so City Carton can sell and get the highest value out of the recyclables. But there's always going to be a certain portion of the population, and there's always going to be certain circumstances that we're not allowed to recycle or it's not available to us. So it ends up going into the trash. Well, FiberRight will take that material, that trash, before it goes to the landfill and pull out everything that we possibly can to recycle. And some of the stuff is going to be made into renewable fuels like ethanol and methane. And only 20% of what actually ends up in the garbage is true garbage. That 20% will eventually make it to the landfill, but we want to go through it first and make sure we get all of our recycling out. So, like I said, it's more of an insurance policy that recycling happens to everything.
Now, we were talking earlier about people who don't rinse out their peanut butter containers, and that can be gross. But, boy, we're not talking about clean garbage here.
How do you process it? Right. And if you have an opportunity, FiberRight.com, there's a 6-minute video on the recycling process itself. And it starts with what I like to call a steam clean machine. So all of the solid waste goes into the steam clean machine, and it's sanitized for the most part. It's tumbled. It's there's water or steam that's added. It reaches high temperatures, and it comes out clean. So the plastic bags that Sioux Waters can use, it'll be clean. The plastics Joe was talking about, it's all clean and ready to go to markets rather to the landfill.
All right. And you also mentioned turning garbage into renewable fuels like ethanol. How does that process work?
It's pretty interesting. And to simplify it, it goes through, after it's done with the steam clean machine, it goes into a washing machine, it goes to a cook, and then it's fed, and then once it's cooked, it's fed to enzymes, and those enzymes eat the organics and turn it into sugar. And then that sugar water is what is sent to the ethanol production. And then the wash water, the dirty wash water, it's just full of organics, that's sent to something called anaerobic digestion. And that anaerobic digestion is what creates the methane. And Fibrite is actually going to use that methane to power their plant. So it's a totally closed-loop recycling system. It's a pretty neat system.
And how widespread is Fibrite right now?
It's just getting started. They've been in the research and development phase because this is a brand-new way of looking at recycling. And they've been in the research and development phase since 2007. They have over 4,000 hours of operating this type of system, and their R&D plant is located in Lawrenceville, Virginia, and they're building a renewable fuels biorefinery in Blairstown, Iowa, and then we've just closed on a deal with purchasing land in Marion, Iowa, where we'll be building a recycling center for trash coming in, and that is what's going to feed Blairstown.
And what is your timeline for this? When will all of this be operational?
It should be operational by the first quarter of 2015.
And we've talked about the amount of energy that has to go into these processes. What is the payoff with producing ethanol, given all of the things that have to go on to make the washing, the steaming, the cooking, and processing happen?
Right. I think you have to look at it as a whole. So all of the steps, you know, like what Joe said with City Carton, all of the steps that they do is adding value to the material that we're bringing in. So, you know, the plant isn't just depending on ethanol. It's not just depending on methane. It's not just depending on the recyclables coming in. And then what Scott said, at the end of this process, we're going to have a material that can be composted, and that's going to return the soil organic matter back to the earth so we can grow more food. So all of those systems put together, it creates a very good business model on what to do to divert material from the landfill as opposed to just burying those resources. And according to a 2011 waste sort from the Iowa DNR, just paper, metal, plastic, and organics was 73% of what we throw away.
Oh, Stacy, thank you so much for telling us about this project today.
Yeah, thank you.
Stacy Johnson is Education Outreach and Market Development Coordinator for Fibrite in Linn County. We've been talking about recycling this hour on Talk of Iowa. We continue our summer series at noon on River to River with a look at trash. This is Talk of Iowa.